All right. Welcome, everybody. It's the Roll Around the Barrel podcast. Vintage Baseball's podcast talking to players from coast to coast, border to border, getting to know them better than you already do. Before I bring in tonight's guest, I just wanted to say something quick. I don't talk about the COVID a lot. I'm not going to talk about the COVID a lot. Everybody's handling it in a different way, but I want you to know something. Somewhere in your life, a friend or a relative, somebody's going through a hard time and probably some depression. So I just want you to think about finding that person and seeing if you can help them out. You all have one. Trust me. And see what you can do about that. It's a tough time. So just be kind to others. On the phone line, tonight's guest from the beautiful city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, it's Matthew Stoke Elbertson of the Athletics Baseball Club of, do you consider yourself of Philadelphia?
Of Philadelphia, yes, sir.
How you doing tonight, Matthew?
I am outstanding. I got a cigar, I got bourbon, and I get to talk about baseball and vintage baseball. Nothing gets better.
Oh, my God. Would your nickname have anything to do with the cigars that you smoke?
It does, and we can get into that tonight.
Every picture I pull up of you is with you with a cigar. And
I'm very photogenic.
And so are your cigars. Much respect. And you got the bourbon. And
yes.
Well, you're doing it right. You're an old soul. You're an old soul at 31 years old, Mr. Elbertson.
And that's right.
I love that. Let's tell me a little bit before I get into your personal experience from childhood up until now in baseball. Tell me a little bit about that club, the Athletics Baseball Club of Philadelphia.
All right, sure. So, Athletic was formed in 2010. As most clubs do, people get interested in a particular thing. They formed a club. They played games. In our case, it's my understanding that we lost a lot of games, but that went with the territory. So we're 10 years old. As far as I know, we are the only team I've come across that wears all wool uniforms, from wool caps, wool tops, wool pants. Our aim is historical accuracy as much as possible, and also community engagement, to get involved with the community. So some clubs have a lot of fast pitch softball or slow pitch softball players on their clubs out there to play a different style game of baseball. We're more of a 1860s model social club that happens to play baseball albeit poorly.
So I'm going to ask a question that, of course, if you're out in the public and you're doing social events and everything, you get asked this question all the time and by other players as well. How hot do those wool pants get?
That's a great question. So if you do any research on textiles, in particular wool, you will find wool is a smart fabric, for lack of a better term. And what it does is while you sweat underneath of it, once you sweat through it, basically, it's almost like air conditioning, because it wicks the moisture away from your body, which is really what you want, especially in the Northeast when it's all muggy and humid and stuff like that. But for those who aren't interested in that particular type of uniform top, we also have a 100% hemp linen top that's somewhere in the summer.
Oh. Now, do those wool pants have like the quilt design in it, like the cross, like the little squares?
No, it's like a typical pair of just wool trousers, blue wool trousers, made by KMP Weaver. They make the tops and the bottoms, and they primarily focus on Civil War reenactment uniforms, things like that.
So you guys are want to represent the historical accuracy of the baseball, and you've gone all out, and you say you're one of the few teams you've ever heard of that does the all wool uniforms. You're the only team I've ever heard of that does all wool uniforms.
Okay, you talk to more folks across the country than I do, so I'll take your word for it.
When you go out into the public and everything, and you guys obviously love, every team has the guys that just love to go out and share the history and show what we do and show the bats and show the balls and talk about the rules and how things were different back then and all of that. What are some of the thing that you guys do on a annual basis? Do you guys go around to some schools or some stuff like that?
We don't. And it's kind of interesting. People have heard about us over 10 years. We've kind of built a reputation in the region. So we will have organizations or individuals reach out about particular events that they're interested in having us at. Whether it be statue, monument dedications, speaking engagements. There's a local clothier down at in Philadelphia that does Philadelphia-based T-shirts, nostalgia wear, stuff like that. We've had members go down there and talk about 1860s baseball. We had a Red Bank Battlefield in New Jersey reach out to us this year about doing some sort of a participatory demonstration with visitors that were coming for a special event day there. So whatever reason, people reach out with different things every year.
I assume you guys have your own umpire.
It depends. If we get enough people out, yes. Two seasons ago, one of our members, Flame, he came decked out in Victorian attire almost every game for us and umpired, which was nice, but it's not all the time.
Sure, sure. Save those for special occasions. So let's go back when young Matthew is just getting old enough to understand the world and he's introduced to sports and recreational activities, maybe not baseball right away. We're about to find out, but tell me about your life as a baseball fan from your earliest memories up until today.
Sure. So I was born in 88. So as you mentioned earlier, I'm 30 going on 31. The earliest baseball memory I really have was watching the movie Sandlot, which dropped in 1993. And really, that's the first time I was introduced to Babe Ruth, the history of the game, and what makes baseball America's pastime. So, you know, that really excited me. I wanted to know more, even though there was really no way for me to know more aside from the movie The Sandlot. And then later that year, I just remember walking into my parents' room. My dad and my brother were watching something on the TV. And they had really concerned looks on their faces. And I walked in, I saw they were watching baseball, and I said, well, the Yankees are better. And I can't believe I ever said that in my life, but I'll admit it nationally. Because I knew, you know, Babe Ruth was all I knew.
Right.
I knew he played for the Yankees. And they said not this year. And the more I think about it, they were watching the 93 World Series. With the concerned looks on their faces, it's probably Mitch Williams in one of the games. He was always, you know, a disaster in the ninth. But that's really my earliest memory of baseball.
And so you watch The Sandlot. It's one of your favorite movies as a kid. You obviously, because you held in the information about Babe Ruth, and you see other members of your family watching baseball. So you become a baseball fan. Am I right?
Yeah, it kind of evolved from there. My dad's more into football, but for whatever reason, I gravitated towards baseball after that.
So what baseball did you play throughout your youth?
So I actually played 1 year of Little League baseball, I think when I was probably 7-ish. And fun fact, when you get that little card, you know, they made baseball cards of every kid. in the terrible looking uniforms, they asked like, "Who's your favorite baseball player?" And I was the only one with a dead guy on the back. I said Babe Ruth. I played 1 year. About 7 years old, I struck out every single at bat except the two times I got beaned because I was too afraid to step closer to the plate.
Wow.
It was really sad.
So 1 year Little League, so you don't play in high school and you don't play after high school. You probably go right into softball, don't you? When you're out of high school?
In college, I did. I went into church league softball. And in high school, I was a 2-year letter winner in track, and I did football too. So I was a dual sport athlete. But baseball didn't come back around until college when I did, you know, recreational softball with a bunch of old dudes.
What events were you running in track in high school?
I did the long jump and the triple jump.
Oh my God, that triple jump.
So 20 foot long jump and 40 foot triple.
And did you tinker around with any other events that you weren't specializing in?
Yeah, I was always extremely fast. And I realized that kind of in elementary school, and I was always winning the 100 meter in field day, which is what we had in middle school and high school, well, elementary and middle school. And I really wanted to be in league matches in track. So, you know, I looked at the roster of everybody doing the sprints, and I'm a freshman coming in, and they had seniors that were running, you know, numbers in the 10. So I knew I wasn't going to get there. I thought, well, I can probably jump. So I just kind of stuck with it. I got the opportunity to run the 4x100 meter relay once. And that was okay, but, never got to do the sprints like I wanted to.
So your speed, what are you playing over in football?
I was a wide receiver, split end, flanker, either or. And then defensive back, primarily a corner.
Did being a wide receiver help you play cornerback, or did being a cornerback help you play wide receiver?
I sucked at both, so I couldn't really tell you.
But you were fast. You got open.
Yeah, I got open.
Did you have the dropsies?
But no, I just wasn't good enough. Put it to you plainly. There were guys on our team that ended up going to college for this stuff, and I just wasn't as invested. I'm only 5'9", too, so I'm average height.
Hey, when you were younger, were you a collector of baseball cards?
In a way. So my uncle used to work for Donruss in some capacity. I don't know what it was. But this is what I was told. So in his house, his basement was full of junk era baseball cards. And the first time I ever went over there to visit their house, he just dumped a bunch of these late 80s, early 90s cards off on me. Like we're talking like 1989 Donruss, 1999 Donruss, 93 Leaf, 92 Leaf, you know, wax packs, full sets. And these things, they aren't worth a lot because they were, you know, they're overproduced. But that was my baseball card collecting. So I was like 10, 15 years late on the kind of cards I was getting at the time, but I didn't care.
Sure. Well, yeah, it didn't really matter.
Greg Jeffries, future star. That's what it said on the card.
And, and he wasn't.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, terrible.
So you brought up 1993. So I bring up, we're going to get into the Phillies later. How many people can you name off the 1993 Philadelphia Phillies? I'm going to let you name them until you get one wrong.
All right. So behind the plate, you got Darren Dalton, first base, John Kruk, Mickey Morandini, second base, shortstop. shortstop primarily was Kevin Stocker, although he started the year in AAA. Third base, Dave Mikey Holland. Right field was a platoon between Wes Chamberlain and Jim Eisenreich. Center field, of course, Lenny the Dude Dykstra, or Nails. And left field was also a platoon, I think, with Wes Covington and Pete Incaviglia.
Oh, that's where you're wrong.
I screwed up. Well, Pete was in left. I know that much.
You got it. You got that it was a platoon. You got Pete Incaviglia, but the other person was Milt Thompson.
Oh, yes. Hitting coach for the Phillies. And it'd be a hitting coach, yeah.
Oh, my God. But that was very impressive, I got to tell you. I just
appreciate
pulled out a random year, and you just were like, yeah, Morandini.
That's right, just the way Harry Callis used to say it. Now, I will say that having World Series baseball on Sega Genesis helped, you know, iron all of that out.
Sure. But come on, Kevin Stocker, you pulled Kevin Stocker.
yeah. Oh, and I will say, in memoriam, rest in peace, Kim Batiste, backup player who goofed in the NLCS and then ended up winning the game in extras for the Phillies. So a backup player, infielder, but he died, I think, last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right, way to bring us down. So
this podcast waxes and wanes, baby.
You so you get into the softball, church league, softball, fist fight, and yep. You do all that. So tell me how you come across vintage baseball.
That's a great question. So my senior year of high school, I graduated, thank God. Nobody thought I'd get there. And my aunt and uncle had a timeshare. They said, hey, we got a timeshare. Where do you want to go? They're both retired military. And I said, you know, I'd love to go to Yellowstone. So what we ended up doing was we took their motorhome across the country out to Yellowstone, stopping at various points along the way. And my grandfather drove cross-country tractor trailer for his career. And he always drove Fords. So Ford was kind of in the family. We visited the Rouge factory in Dearborn, Michigan, and of course Greenfield Village. So when we get there, we, you know, spelunk around and see in the program that there's this vintage baseball thing. And, you know, I'm jazzed about it. I'm all fired up about baseball because the Phillies are getting hot finally. And I love history. That's what I wanted to study in college. They put the two together. It makes perfect sense. Unfortunately, they didn't play a game that day. We were there during the week. But that's the first time I really came across vintage baseball.
So you went to the Henry Ford Museum. What are your yep. favorite memories of what you saw in that museum?
So I think my favorite part was probably, this goes to my career choice too, the Menlo Park exhibit that they have there. Pretty sprawling facility, and you know, they had a historian there that gave the rundown on Edison as Thomas Edison, and we asked him a question about Edison's life, and he had no clue, so he was a really crappy actor or historian, either or. I like that, and it's kind of, you know, I guess a Debbie Downer sort of thing, but I thought the chair that Lincoln got shot in at Ford's Theater was kind of strange to be there, but, you know, you could see the stain on the top of the headrest, so that was pretty impactful.
Yeah, the stain, I don't know if you know this, is not blood.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
You're going to be disappointed when you hear this. But that is hair product.
No kidding. Oh, that's outstanding though.
There are now from what, and I believe Jeff Kozlowski, told me this, and I wonder if it's on his episode. He plays for the Greenfield Village La-Di-Das, and he used to be a tour guide for the museum. And I think he said they did find some blood on the chair, but they don't know who it belonged to.
Makes sense. Okay.
But that stain is a hair product. So crazy, yeah. And did they have Thomas Edison's like workshop? That's what that Menlo Park thing is, right? Is his lab?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So, yeah, I have not gone to that. But what you're saying, but like I walked into a house, you know how they have all the houses, and I walked into like the Wright brothers' house, which I think is right over by that. And
it is. Yep.
And then somebody, you know, gives you the history and the lowdown of the Wright brothers. So is the laboratory of Thomas Edison, is that like a bigger exhibit? Did you walk through many rooms and stuff?
It's pretty much a really large open garage. I mean, it's pretty large. I couldn't give you a dimension today, but from my understanding, they disassembled it back east and reassembled it there at Greenfield Village. At least that's what I was told. That could be wrong, but it was pretty big.
Is Thomas Edison? Maybe it's not Thomas Edison. I'm looking it up right now. Don't they have the last breath of somebody at Greenfield Village?
You know, I wouldn't put it past
it is.
That's outstanding.
Well, it's housed in the Henry Ford Museum as a test tube said to hold Thomas Edison's last breath. And you didn't get to see that. And nobody did because it's just breath. But
that's terrific.
That's crazy. So you get introduced vintage baseball. You head back to, have you been living in Philadelphia your whole life?
No. So I'm originally from central Pennsylvania, in a college town out there. And then moved to the Philadelphia area for grad school.
And, so how does vintage baseball, what do you do with it? You stick it in your pocket when you leave Greenfield Village. What do you do with it?
Absolutely nothing. it kind of just laid dormant. And when I got to grad school, I was introduced to Sabre. And so I joined as a Sabre member in about 2015. And I was really attracted because they would let basically anybody write articles, whether it be in a book or just on the website. So, you know, that piqued my interest. And I was just going down rabbit holes one night on Google instead of reading some book by Browdell or whoever, and came across the Athletic Baseball Club of Philadelphia, the vintage team. And, I dove into it. My program at Villanova was public history, so museums, archives, historic sites, living history. And I thought, what better way to practice this than to actually play vintage baseball rules?
And so what do you think the first time you catch a baseball with no glove?
I didn't know what to expect. It hurt. I knew that much. It hurt, and then when I threw it back, I realized I wasn't very accurate with throwing. So I had a chaser on the other end, but it was different. That's for sure. You're used to having that pocket, you know, when you grow up starting in Little League or wherever, and you're used to having that pocket there. And you actually, if you do that kind of thing with the vintage baseball, it's going to hit you in the fingertips and hurt your fingers. So.
Right. What year was it that you joined the Athletic?
2015.
And so you've been with them. How did your season go this year with the Cooties?
There was no season. We took it month by month because we weren't sure what was going to happen. So each month, the officers and myself, we jumped on Zoom calls and, you know, discuss what was going on. Our field this year, we actually moved field this year from Philadelphia City proper to Delaware County, which is the next county over from Philadelphia County. Very close. And so the property we're on now is owned and maintained by Delaware County. Well, because of COVID, they had shut everything down. So we knew we couldn't host any home games. And the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania also had basically a ban on any major social events. So we knew we were pretty much dead in the water until the governor lifted these bans or went from red to yellow to green.
So you're probably only in yellow right now, right?
No, that system basically went away July into August. We are now, I guess you could say, in the green phase. And just last week, the governor relaxed regulations again. So now they're actually allowed to have fans at the Eagles game, which is unfortunate for the other team or for the Eagles, depending on who's playing worse.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about the Eagles later. You know, I live in Michigan, but I'm a huge Miami Dolphins fan. And let me tell you, before we recorded, I found out Le'Veon Bell's going to the Chiefs, so I'm ticked. But
oh, he is?
Yeah, on a one-year deal. But the governor of Florida opened it up all the way for the Dolphins to allow 65,000 fans into the stands.
Wow.
And we're like,
wow.
What? And the Dolphins said, no thanks, we'll stick to around 13. How many are the Eagles letting in right now?
I think the max they can allow is 10% capacity. Uh-huh. And I think that includes players and staff and the whole nine like that. So it's only a couple thousand.
Yeah, but anything helps. You know, I watch a Red Zone channel. I don't even notice the fans, so I don't even miss it. I'm fine.
They pump in the fake crowd noise and you're there.
That's right. That's all I need. What are some of the, going back to the finished baseball, what are some of your favorite events that you've been able to play in the last 5 years?
So we really don't venture out too much like some of the other clubs that you've talked with, Diamond State, Black Bart, and the Atlantics with Dean. But we go to Gettysburg every year. That's hosted in July. And, you know, that's really an outstanding place. It's not a tournament per se. It's a festival. You're there for the love of the game, basically, and you get to play teams from all across the country. So that's always a good time. We played at Cooperstown once, I think 2 or 3 years ago, up at the Amagang Brewery. And the year we played, the field that they placed behind the brewery, right there off their patio, it's terrible. It's like the field from hell. The infield was all dirt and rocks and large stones. And then there was a huge hill in the background for the outfield. So you weren't doing any sliding. You weren't diving anywhere. Balls were taking crazy hops every which way. But the people who showed up to the brewery really enjoyed it. So the people that got engaged in the game and started cheering for teams and good play, you know, that was my first experience with a festival/tournament style play. And I really enjoyed that. And we host, Athletic hosts our own festival biannually. It was supposed to be this year, but unfortunately we had to cancel it. And again, that's not a competitive tournament. That's a For Love of the Game festival, traditionally held at the end of the season in September, where we'll get teams from the region, New York. I think on one occasion we got a team from Denver to come out. So those would be the favorite places, I would say, as far as festivals go. And even though I've only played there once, up on Long Island, we played the Atlantics up there. I think it's Smithtown. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but they really have a terrific field out there and a good partnership with the Historical Society.
Yeah, having a good partnership with your local Historical Society or museum or wherever, that is always a big help.
Yes.
And it's kind of a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, but on a much friendlier basis. And tell me who you're, I'm putting you on the spot now. Tell me your favorite vintage baseball player to watch that's not on your team.
Well, two of them are catchers, which sucks because here in the East, it's steal whenever you want, whenever you can. But I'll start off Dutch with the Diamond State Club. He's got a cannon for an arm. He runs the base as well. He can hit a ton. And he's not a jerk about any of it. Sometimes you get those guys that are overly competitive. But Dutch, he's a great gamesmanship. He's a, you know, a great, great player, great gamesmanship. Always fun to play against. Black Bart, also from Diamond State, Matt Bartnicki. I'll tell you later a little bit about our club, but we're really good with razzing during the games. Typically, it's self-deprecating, but Black Bart has a good time with us when that starts to happen, and he's also one hell of a baseball player. And then finally, Ketch, the catcher for Kenneth Square. Kenneth Square, I think, is a team of lumberjacks. they just murder the baseball. So their entire team is really a marvel to watch, but himself in particular, just like Dutch, runs the base as well. Cannon for an arm. You really have to choose your spot when you're going to steal a bag.
Tell me more about this razzing that you guys do during gameplay.
Sure. So as I alluded to earlier, we aren't, this is kind of ironic, we aren't very athletic. And you can talk to anybody in our region. They will tell you, and I quote one of the Diamond State players, former president Jeff Swampy, Kabasinski. I'm going to bastardize that name, but I think that's how you say it. He'll tell you that we lead the league in fun every year. So whether we are winning, which is rare, tied, a little less rare, or losing most often, we are always, smack talking either the opponent if we feel they are comfortable with it, or more traditionally ourselves and our poor play. And because we go back and forth with this, and we play a lot of the same teams every year, so the teams we play every year know what we're about. And I'll give you for an example. Last year, we played Diamond State at their place, and I was getting on Black Bart a little bit. I forget what it was about, but then he bounded out to the catcher. So I locked on that, and he's like saying, that never happens. It's never going to happen again. Well, he ended up bounding out to the catcher 3 times that game.
Oh.
And I didn't let it go. And at the end of the day, I thought, yeah, I might have gotten a little tough on him there, but at the end of the day, it was still good. But we do that a lot. We do that a lot. We razz, we talk smack all the time. We're always talking. And a lot of times it's 19th century esque, you know, might not be period like huzzah, hurrah, you know, good ginger, stuff like that. But we'll throw in some stuff from 19th century literature. Something that sounds good. We've got a megaphone from the 19th century. And I remember one time our first baseman during the middle innings decided to talk advertisements to the megaphone. And for example, said this game brought to you by the Civil War, stuff like that.
So you guys sound like you're just having a hell of a time.
Oh, all the time, all the time. That's what the game is for. You know, we've all got day jobs. We're not getting paid to play. Our team in particular, nobody would pay us to play, but you know what? We have a great time.
Have you had to deal with any injuries so far?
Knock on wood, not really. I pitched once last year against Atlantic, and a ball hit off the bound right in front of me, and I thought I had my hands up in time, but I was wrong. It hit me right in the dome. You know, it stunned me real quick, but I didn't have a concussion or anything. And I did have a overheating situation against Talbot a couple of years ago. We didn't have enough players. They didn't have enough players, so we decided to do three teams of five, which was the worst decision in the entire world. So, your typical lineup's nine guys. Well, instead you got five, so you're sprinting around the bases, and then you're up to bat right after that.
Yeah.
So, like I said, in the East Coast, you're stealing all the time too. So everybody's just running themselves ragged. And I didn't drink enough water beforehand, and it got to me. I didn't get heat stroke, but I was seeing spots.
And that sounds like an on the field memory. Do you have a pleasant do you have a pleasant on the field memory?
Pleasant.
Something that sticks out. It doesn't have to be the best one.
Yeah, I've got a couple. 2018 at the Gettysburg Festival, it was raining cats and dogs. And we show up for our first game, which was in the afternoon. And as I said, we wear wool uniforms. And the team we played was New Liberty from New Brunswick, New Jersey. They're up by Rutgers. And they had already played a game. They were soaking wet. And it wasn't – the rain was unrelenting. And we were out there. And due to the properties of wool uniforms and this smart fabric, we were totally comfortable. We were warm. The uniforms weren't too heavy. And we ended up winning the game, and we really credit the uniforms for that. And then, our club is kind of unique. We've got a lot of characters with big personality, and I can share a picture with you after this call, but we took a picture at home plate after that game. We won the ball, so the entire team's standing there soaking wet, smiles with the ball, and our one player, our catcher, Greg, decided to take everything off his body except for his underwear and did a mudslide in the home plate, and he is front and center, leg up in front of him, posing. That was one hell of a game. That was a lot of fun. And then later that year, we played Diamond State at our Navy Yard Festival at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And the thing about that game was it was what we won. So I told you about two wins, which is pretty impressive. So those are memorable automatically for us. But Diamond State that year had won the Silver Ball Tournament, which I know you've heard about.
Sure.
And that is ultra competitive. You've got to beat the snot out of the other competition to win that tournament, to even have a chance to win it. And we ended up beating Diamond State by a run that day. So that was, we felt like on top of the world.
What about anything that's happened off the field with your club or with another club, maybe in a post-match meal together or road trip or anything like that?
Well, the road trips are great, as any player can attest to, but two things stick out in my mind from 2017. I don't know how this guy got my email, but he did, and he was the head of the Octavius Caddo Memorial Statue dedication in Center City, Philadelphia, right at City Hall. And for anybody who doesn't know who Octavius Caddo is, he wore many hats, but he was also the captain of the all-black Philadelphia Pythian baseball team, and they played in one of the earliest interracial games in history in 1869. So the way the monument was set up, they had four or five different pillars set up, one for a specific thing that he did, which was integrating trolley service, getting blacks the right to vote, education. He helped found an HBCU, which is now Cheney University. And then there was athlete, which, involved us. So we were asked to have a couple members come down, be part of that memorial dedication. David Montgomery, former chairman, rest in peace, of the Phillies, and David Buck, I think, part owner of the Phillies. They met us down there, as the other part of the athlete reveal part of the statue. So that was pretty special. That was a big moment. And we were down there in uniform, head to toe. And they also had that day a couple of Cato's descendants who had arrived in the city that day from New England. And we were able to present them with what we had done some research on for a Pythian uniform top. It wasn't made out of wool. I think it was made out of the hemp linen, but that picture is available on Facebook as well. So, you know, that's one of the biggest community engagement things we've ever done as a club. Personally, also later that year, actually a couple weeks after that, I had kind of spearheaded my own thing to get a Pennsylvania State historical marker erected at the site of the Jefferson Street grounds in Brewery Town, which is, I would guess you'd say, Northwest Philadelphia. What's important about that is that's where that interracial game between the Pythians and the Olympics took place in September 1869. It got national coverage, so it wasn't the first game between two clubs of different color, but it got national attention, and they were two of the most important clubs in the nation at that time. So there was that there, and it also held the first Major League Baseball game in history. I say that tongue-in-cheek. That's the way MLB defines it. It was the first National League game in history on April 22nd, 1876, between the Athletics and the Boston Club. Also took place there. So I was able to dedicate a sign, a Pennsylvania State historical marker that day. My teammates showed up. They helped fund the sign with me. It was, you know, a grassroots movement. And we were able to play some Philadelphia town ball with attendees, including some of the kids that were there at the site. And I don't know how I missed this, but that site where the sign is located is actually the site of the Athletic Recreation Center, aptly named because that's where the Athletics held their home games in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s. And on the site of the American Association Athletics Field, Athletic Park, is a baseball diamond. So the sign is pretty close to that. Sorry to ramble.
No, please do. You know your history. You love your history. I guess it's no surprise. You mentioned it earlier that you're a member of the Society for American Baseball Research, the Connie Mack chapter. You were doing writings and stuff in the beginning. How did that evolve into your current participation?
Well, it was just small. I was kind of curious about, you know, I know I can write. You know, I had my bachelor's degree in history at that time, working on the master's. I knew I could write effectively. I knew I could research really well. And just like a lot of things with what I do, I went down a rabbit hole on Google one day at work, and there are Pennsylvania State historical markers to Scheid Park, to Baker Bowl, to Veterans Stadium. And I'd done some reading about this Jefferson Street grounds for a while. I went on the Google Maps and there was no sign, and I said, I got to do it. My wife probably wanted to kill me because that took up a lot of my time and a lot of our time. Just researching it, doing the nomination forms, getting the state approval, which was like an incredible day. And then actually dedicating the sign, you know, to finally conclude it. So, you know, if something comes up that I find might be a pretty cool pet project, I have no problem getting down and dirty and rolling up my sleeves and diving into it.
So since you know your history and earlier, I quizzed you on the 1993 Philadelphia Phillies. I just pulled up the 1983 Philadelphia Phillies. Go until you get one wrong.
The Wheeze Kid. I'm a little weaker on this one.
I bet you can get half of the starting lineup, though.
All right, so Mike Schmidt, that's easy. We'll get that one out of the way.
Yep.
Joe Morgan was on that team. Pete Rose was on that team. It's basically the Cincinnati Reds. I don't think, I might be wrong, Gary Maddox, was he still on the team then?
Yes, sir, center field.
He got traded soon thereafter. Manny Trio, I think, was second base.
No, second base was Joe Morgan.
Joe Morgan, right. Manny Trio had gotten traded. He was with the team in 80.
One of your backups
Larry Boa.
Was a very old, actually, Larry Milbourne and a very young Juan Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep.
Come on, right?
And John Denny, I think, is his name. I think he was the starting pitcher. I think he won the Cy Young that year, maybe.
Yeah, Steve Carlton, John Denny. I don't know if he won the Cy Young Award. But
by the way, Darren Dalton was also on that team for a handful of games.
See, you know that stuff. How do you know that stuff? Like Darren Dalton
and unique.
Darren Dalton was in two games.
And I think Ryan Sandberg was in like five.
Nope, they don't have him on here. That must have been a different year.
So he's still in the minors then. Okay. Was Bake McBride still on the team in right field?
I don't think so. The right field was Von Hayes, and I had a ton of Von Hayes baseball cards. That's how come I know the name Von Hayes. I had way too many of them. Yeah, there was
traded for four guys and Julio Franco among others.
Wow. Tony Perez was on this team too.
Yes, that's the other guy. That's the other Red. I couldn't remember.
You just took all the old Reds guys?
Yes, exactly. They had what, three or four of them on that team at the very least.
So we'll do the smooth transition into Bryce Harper talk now. You informed me that you heard the Matt Barnicki episode, and hi Matt Barnicki out there. Bryce Harper, give me your take on Bryce Harper.
So first of all, I didn't like him before he got to Philly just because he was really good. And I thought he was a prima donna. And then when you realize that he's actually going to be a free agent, the Phillies need a right fielder. And they can go after this guy. I was like, you know what? That guy's a jerk. but our city is known for jerks, and he's going to be our jerk. So I latched on to Bryce Harper instead of Manny Machado, even though I felt Manny Machado was a better player. But you know what? If you look at traditional stats, Bryce Harper hasn't been worth the money. I will say that if you actually look at stats that matter, like OPS, OPS plus, WAR, that Bryce Harper has been worthwhile for the team. He's been a terrific teammate. At least he said all the right things, which is good for him. And number one that people forget about when they say, oh, well, he's not worth $330 million. The Phillies sold out of Bryce Harper jerseys almost immediately when they went and hit the presses that first year. He puts butts in seats. He got the city excited after baseball is basically a forgotten sport in the city. And people get a charge out of Bryce Harper today. It doesn't matter if they're playing the White Sox on a random June night and Vince Velasquez screws the game up in left field because he forgot to get the guy out. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Bryce Harper's on our team. He's our guy. And he's worth the price of admission. And he's worth the price tag you're paying him.
So I know you rattled off a bunch of those stats. The ones that he's good at. But what about the ones that he's bad at? How about this batting average that's not so great?
Sure, let's talk about batting average. What's his batting average tell you?
His batting average tells me that he...
batting average alone.
Batting average is...
Batting average alone.
How many hits, official hits you get percentage-wise, basically, out of your at-bats?
Does it does batting average tell me whether it was a single, double, triple, home run, or otherwise?
No, that would be slugging percentage.
That's right. Does it tell me stats on hit by pitch, intentional walk, base on balls, anything like that?
So that's on base percentage, but his on base percentages aren't great.
So here we're talking about batting average alone, right? And all batting average says is that he has, or a particular player has a high, medium, or low percentage of getting on base just by hitting the ball. It doesn't tell you if he's a singles hitter, a home run hitter, and an extra base machine. It doesn't tell you any of that. But when batting average is valuable, is if it's, say, for example, batting average with runners in scoring position. That's valuable to me, because if I got a guy on second or third and I got a player that's hitting .350 with runners in scoring position, well, that's a great stat. I don't care if he's hitting .230 overall, but when it counts, when the runners are on base, he's getting them home. Now, a .962 OPS this past season is actually substantially above average, which I believe an average OPS is 700, 750-ish. So that's beyond all-star caliber.
I can't.
What else you got?
What else do I got? I can't deny that he's a good player. I've never said he's not a good player. But I don't think 260 and 249 and 268. I know all the other stats too, but the guy, he doesn't get hit by pitches that often.
No.
He strikes out a ton.
He does.
So those stats don't mean anything. He's a good player.
Overall, as a hitter, as a guy in the box, is he getting on base? Is he driving in runs? Is he hitting for extra bases? And the answer is yes. Do I care how he gets on base? No. Do I care if it's an irrelevant, you know, he got on base with the batted ball? No. Tell me how. And overall, that OPS tells me that he is absolutely an above average, two great player.
I will never say that he's not a good player. I am always on board with the fact that he's a good player. He was he's obviously not ruffling any feathers in Philadelphia like he was in Washington D.C. He's like
keeping
quiet. That's for sure. You don't hear anything out of him really.
No, he's really taken on the team leadership role, and I think he's grown up a little bit. To be honest with you, I think he grew up. To an extent.
So my only argument about him ever is he's just not worth the contract. But your point about how much merch he sells is actually right on the money. But he's not as popular as he was.
No, he's not. And he's not because I think you've got a lot of very exciting players in the outfield now. You got Buxton in Minnesota. You've got Juan Soto in Washington, the fake Nationals. I hate the Nationals. You've got Christian Yelich. You've got Aaron Judge, Mike Trout, who is lost on the wrong side of Los Angeles. You've got some outstanding talent out there, some really exciting players. And I think to an extent he gets lost in it a little bit.
I think he needs to go back to being a diva.
I will say this. When I moved down here for grad school in 2014, that was when the team started to do this thing called a rebuild, and they really haven't gotten out of it yet. But anyway, I've seen Delmon Young in right field. That guy takes the shortest steps of any man alive, even when he's running. ALCS MVP, who cares? I've seen Peter Borges, who went up to the plate with knobs at both ends of the bat. He couldn't hit a lick. I've seen so many atrocities, a calamity of errors in Philadelphia's right field. So Bryce Harper is a relief that I can just pencil him in out there. It'll be okay.
That's true. You can just pencil him in. I'm not going to lie about it. I don't think he makes a team better. I think he's just a good player. And that's where we're going to leave it on that. $330 million. I'm more concerned.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
I'm more concerned about the length of his contract, actually.
Say again?
I hate those long contracts that people get when they're like the Albert Pujols, where they're just terrible at the end, and you just got to watch it, and it's painful. Like Miguel Cabrera here in Michigan, it's painful to watch. We'll move on to the Philadelphia Eagles. What in the hell has happened to the Philadelphia Eagles since they won the Super Bowl?
Don't know, don't care. I was there that night in Center City when they won the game, and I was there for the parade. That's all I know. What a time.
What is a parade for the Eagles in Philadelphia? What does that look like?
You know, it's funny. I figured it would be bonkers, off the wall, stereotypical Philadelphia sports fan. But it wasn't. It was pretty subdued. People were going nuts, of course. They were going absolutely bonkers for the team. I was at South and Broad Streets. I lined up there, I think it was like 6:30 to get a spot. But the parade was disappointing compared to, you know, being down on Broad Street the night that they won the game. The night that they won the game, that was easily top three moment in my life. Is at Cigar Lounge with my wife. And you've seen Ken Burns baseball, yes?
Yeah.
So in Ken Burns baseball, they talk about when the Red Sox win the World Series in 2007, and church bells all across New England went off. And I thought, oh, that's nice. That's cute. Well, there's a firehouse next to our cigar shop. And when Tom Brady's pass hit the ground at the end of the game, the fire alarm went off, and it was loud. So we all flow outside. People are going nuts, honking horns and everything like that. We sprint down to Center City, Philly, and there's just a crush of people down there downtown. There are two police officers on Broad Street just kind of standing there thinking, why the hell did I take the shift tonight? people were climbing the poles, the street signs. And even though they had greased the poles, some guy got to the top of this pole, started celebrating, and people started throwing full beers at him. I mean, it was incredible. It was a mess. I sold three cigars to a guy in a car next to me for like $10, a three pack for $10, which I got ripped off. But he was like, yo, you got more cigars? I was like, yeah, we got more cigars. We had champagne going out of the car. It was incredible. It was incredible.
That sounds fantastic. And now you're spoiled because now you don't care because now you had it.
It's like we reached the pinnacle and it's kind of there. To be honest with you, what's going on with the current team is the roster is bloated with big contracts and aging players who are more often than not injured. You know, it was a cute story in 2017 when it seemed like a quarter of the roster was injured and they still won the whole thing. But they don't have that anymore. That spark is gone. Those players, a lot of them are gone or injured often, and they really need to just tear it down and rebuild.
Yep, and they will. They look awful. the whole division, that's the worst division in football. That is brutal.
Hey, baby, we're still in it. We're still in it.
That's somehow. Right. Still in it.
Only a game back.
You just have to get hot. For 3 weeks.
We don't have to get hot. We got to win four more games.
Hey, I know that you watch a lot of streaming, Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime. Tell the people what you've been watching and give us some recommendations.
All right. So I watch Ken Burns baseball religiously. It's a deep, dirty secret. My wife hates it. She's giving me a stink eye now. But we've actually started watching Cheers. I don't know why, but we started watching Cheers, and that's got a baseball tie into it too, with Mayday Malone being a former Red Sox pitcher. Terrific show. If you've never seen it, for the younger crowd, really, really funny. Waiting for The Mandalorian to drop at the end of the month, I think it is. So looking forward to that again. Just finished binging The Goldbergs. So I went on furlough in March and went back to work in the beginning of August. And my wife was on maternity leave for that time, too. So we found out if we liked each other or not. Turns out we still do. We still like each other. That was good to know. But we basically watched the entire thing of Goldbergs, which was great. Based in Philadelphia. And if you're really wondering, the actor who does Adam Goldberg, I think he's from the Midwest, but I'll tell you what, his accent for this area is spot on. Spot on.
I've never sat down and watched an episode of that show. It's got that, the mother is from that Reno 911. I believe.
I've never watched it, but I hear it's good.
And they just came out with a reboot kind of thing. What I've been watching lately is my recommendations out there for everybody is I watched the documentary on the murder of the Watts family by the husband, Chris Watts. That was crazy. I don't recommend murder. I just recommend the documentary. I just got caught up on a bunch of stuff. I just finished The Boys on Amazon Prime. I just found out today that Dexter's coming back for 10 more episodes.
Heard about that.
I'm pretty excited about that as long as they don't screw it up like they did the finale. And we're watching Blacklist right now on Netflix. We never watched it on TV, but Blacklist has caught our interest. It's very, very well done, but you have to, it is not one of those shows you can just have on and just casually watch. If you're distracted by anything, don't watch it. You have to have full attention on that show, but it's really well done.
Interesting. One more thing I'll mention is we finished a couple months ago. We finished binging The Sopranos for the first time. And I know nobody cares what I had to say about the last episode, but I wasn't a fan. That's all I'll say. I'll leave it at that. I get why they did it. It was creative, sure. Didn't care.
But take away the last episode. How did you feel about the show?
Overall, the show is just absolutely unbelievable. Incredible show. If you haven't seen it, you know, pay the $15 a month for HBO Max and watch it. It is outstanding.
I had I think I've only watched like one or two episodes. One of the women in there was in Goodfellas. She was Henry Hill's wife.
Yes.
So they've got all the stereotypical Italian actors in there. I should probably get into that a little bit. All right, what we're going to do right now, Matt, is I used to do 20 random questions. I've lowered it down to 10. As to coming up with 20 was, I'm just not that smart. to keep coming up with new 20 questions. So I've lowered it in season two. I've lowered it to 10. So here we go. 10 random questions.
All right.
What was your first automobile?
You're breaking up a lot, so I can't really hear anything you're saying.
Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Okay. What was your first automobile?
First automobile, Ford Ranger.
Do you prefer bottled or tap water?
Bottled.
Jalen Hurts or Carson Wentz?
Carson Wentz.
Have you ever broken up with someone just before a holiday to avoid buying them presents?
Nope.
Name an overrated Major League Baseball player.
Giancarlo Stanton.
Adrian Balboa, caring wife or kind of a drag?
Caring wife.
What is your favorite breakfast?
Ooh, French toast.
Who is the most famous person you've met?
Roy Halladay.
What is your Mount Rushmore of Halloween candy you got trick-or-treating as a kid?
Snickers. All four spots.
Oh, jeez. No, I'm not going to let you do it. Snickers is one. Nope, I'm not going to let you do it. Three more.
Snickers, Milky Way, Kit Kat, and Crunch.
Is that the Nestle's Crunch? Yeah. Those are all candy bars. Your candy choices are good, but they're not very adventurous, I have to tell you.
No, not at all.
That's okay. I ain't mad at it. Hey, Matt, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you guys, I love talking to you guys that play kind of on the – you're in Pennsylvania, obviously, but you're – do you consider yourself an East Coast team?
Yes. Yes.
You guys always have such great passion. Great passion for the game. I love talking to you guys, and you are very well steeped in the knowledge of the history, which is explains your Sabre participation, like I said. So thanks for being on the show. Tell everybody where they can go see information about the Athletic Baseball Club of Philadelphia.
Sure. So we are active on, I won't say all, I guess most social media platforms. At Athletic BBC on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. You can also visit our website at PhillyVintageBaseball.org.
And everyone be careful out there. Be good. Matt, stay in line for me so I can give you a proper goodbye.
Sure.
And we'll see you next week with our next episode of the Roll Around the Barrel Vintage Baseball Podcast. Good night, everybody.